future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people out.
Hey, welcome, welcome to Raging Chickens Out to Coop Live. Yes, it is our show for Monday, June 14th, 2021. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards and from across the country. On Fridays, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And yes, you got to tune into our brand new Wednesday show every other week. Progressive columnist from the Bucks County Courier Times, The Intelligencer, Cyril Michaleko, joins me to drill down in Bucks County and PA politics. And you can get all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. You can help support this show by becoming as a patron for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're listening to this show right now on our YouTube channel, well, make sure you're subscribing to this show, making sure you're liking this stream, and make sure you hit that little notification bell so that you know every time we go live. And for more PA Progressive Talk, you can tune in to Rick Smith's show. It's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter. You know, basically any place you're streaming, that's where Rick's at. So you can go check out Rick and go to ricksmithshow.com for the latest from across all his platforms. And you must check out the newly launched Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. Yes, the amazing PA women stirring the political cauldron behind this podcast rock the house. And they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? Yep. Make sure to follow them on Twitter at The Night Caucus and subscribe to their podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And this Friday, yes, especially this Friday, June 18th, Shanna Danielson and Angela Valvano will be joining me as a guest host as Sean Kitchen is still trying to get his parents to stop at a dispensary as he's on vacation or going across the country. Yes, indeed. And for all you gamers out there, The Game Inn is a Quakertown-based black family-owned gaming store. Yes, right in our neighborhood. They're friends of the show and they've got everything from retro N64s to latest consoles, video games for all platforms, collectibles, Funko Pops, you get the idea. And your kids, well, you know, they get a discount with every A on the report card. Just as school comes to a close, so I think it's time to head on over there. Check them out on their Facebook page. Check them out on Twitter at The Game Inn. That's with two N's. Got a question about a game? Just give them a shout at The Game Inn at TheGameInPA@gmail.com. And a special shout out to Jonathan Mann, who wrote the intro song, There Are No People in the Future. And check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at SongADayMan. That's with two N's, at SongADayMan on Twitter. Well, I got to say, on this week's show, I am thrilled to welcome Cory Doctorow to the program to talk about his book, How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism, and hopefully with some of his excellent novels exploring resistance in high-tech surveillance state. And just as luck would have it, we've got a bunch of, you know, big tech bills that are kind of making their way through Congress right now. So there we have it. Cory Doctorow, you can find him at craphound.com. He is a science fiction author, activist, and journalist. His latest book, Attack Surface, it's a standalone adult sequel to the young adult novels Little Brother and Homeland, which I'm introducing my son to right now, which is pretty freaking awesome. You can also check out all this stuff. He's his author of Radicalize and Walk Away, which my colleague, Amy Lynch Biniak, who friends of the show may know, said, you've got to talk to him about Walk Away. I'm like, okay, Amy, okay. Science fiction is science fiction for adults and young adult graphic novel called In Real Life. And his first picture book for younger kids, Posey the Monster Slayer, was released last summer, and it's phenomenal. Well, he maintains a daily blog at pluralistic.net, and he works for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, his MIT Media Lab research affiliate, a visiting professor of computer science at Open University, visiting professor of practice, University of North Carolina School of Library Information Science, and co-founded the UK Open Rights Group. Born in Toronto, Canada, he now lives in Los Angeles. And you can check out all his books and all his latest goings-on over on craphound.com. Cory, and I'm so happy to have you here. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure, Kevin. Thank you for having me on.
Well, you know, like I said a little bit right before we got on an air, you know, this is perfect timing in many ways. And one, we got these bills that are dropping forth in Congress here. But even more so, even just in the recent history, we've had this freak out since the 2016 election when it comes to the power of social media and big tech. And will they be our saviors, or are they the evil twins? Do we have to get rid of them? Or, I mean, how do we deal with these folks? And they've had this weird power, you know, to somehow conjure up the demon that was Donald Trump and put him in there. And all of us were just kind of like, you know, like forced down this road, right? And what I found, and why I wanted to have you on the show, because it seemed like these issues are coming back into the fore right now. And it seemed to me that in reading this book, you just said you want to kind of hit the pause button on the freak out. And let's talk about what is actually at stake here when we're talking about big tech. And are we kind of going to be, you know, victims of the mind control ray, as you talk about in here, or is there something else going on? So, I mean, you know, these issues are front and center into what is defining our entire era in my mind, right?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, the technology is becoming the kind of digital nervous system of the 21st century. I remember a decade ago when Finland was the first country to declare that broadband was a human right.
Right.
And there were a lot of people, both from the left, but also liberals like what's his name? The Tipping Point guy with all the hair. Gosh, I can't believe I just blanked his name. My fellow Canadian, whose name I don't recall, who's a very famous writer and TED talker and so on, was Malcolm Gladwell.
Was
on and on about how, you know, the real social change comes from confronting Bull Connor and the dogs on the bridge, and not from, you know, clicking on links or typing stuff on social media, and that there would be no activist future involving social media. And really, I think that especially the last year has shown us that, you know, while digital is not a substitute for the physical, it's a necessary part of the physical, that, you know, every movement involves has a digital component. And if you lose digital, you lose the fight before it's even joined, that, you know, that single wire that's delivering your free speech and free assembly and access to jobs and tools and ideas and civics and politics and employment and romance and education and healthcare. That, you know, that wire shouldn't be treated like a political football. We shouldn't treat these digital devices like, you know, glorified video on demand services or the world's greatest pornography distribution
system.
Or, you know, jihadi radicalizing systems or QAnon radicalizing systems. You know, they do these things, but they also touch so many other parts of our life that we need to regulate them, but we need to regulate them with care and gravitas, and not to just say, well, you know, Netflix is doing something I don't like in terms of letting my kids see adult content. Let's just make some rules, you know, and not think about what impact that has on so many other parts of our lives as well.
Well, and it seems too that, you know, and we'll get to this certainly. I mean, I don't want to kind of jump the gun to the end of the book here, but, you know, in some ways, the fact that we're facing all these issues at the very time that our democracy is really on the table. Right. In terms of, like, you know, how we're going to be able to kind of, you know, what is going to be the nature of our democracy going forth. And it's also the case as someone like myself, who studies social movements and the rhetorics of social movements and stuff. Of course, social movements have always been kind of embedded in a kind of a media landscape. Right. And at the same time, every time we get a new technological development, there always tends to be this literacy freak out. Right. That somehow that is going to be the downfall of the past order by itself. Right. That the technology by itself. So there's that. But before I get too ahead of it, you know, your book is talking about, you know, how to destroy surveillance capitalism. Let's just set the table with just a couple terms here for folks, so we know what we're talking about when we say these things. Because so let's first, when you're talking about surveillance, right? What do we mean when we say surveillance? I mean, it's not just the guy in the trench coat and the hat and the glasses that sit on the corner taking your picture, right? What are we looking at here?
Well, I would call surveillance the opposite of privacy. So privacy, people think privacy is secrecy. Privacy is not secrecy. I know what you do when you go to the toilet. It takes a special kind of person to want to do it in front of someone else, right? I know what your parents did to make you, but again, like, they probably closed the door while they were doing it. So privacy is not secrecy. And it's not secrecy in another way, which is that there are a lot of things that my wife and I know about each other that you will probably never know about me. it's not a secret, right? My wife knows it. You know, it says, I think it was Benjamin Franklin, two may keep a secret if one of them is dead. Mm-hmm. You know, that it's not a secret. It's just that I'm controlling who gets to know my stuff. I might make some bad choices, right? We all know people who overshare. But the thing that distinguishes privacy from not privacy is whether you are coerced into disclosing the facts of your life or whether you make those choices on your own, for better or for worse.
Right.
And, you know, there's a discussion we could have about whether, you know, kids make good choices about what they disclose on social media and so on. But every time we worry about our kids making disclosures on social media, the undercurrent there is not the disclosures they're making deliberately, right? Where they go on and they say, like, I like Pepsi and TikTok dancing, and, you know, I'm quite fond of that new pop star, right? That's not the part we really worry about. We worry about the part where, like, their social graph and their location and other information about them, like their preferences that are latent in their communications and so on, all that stuff is being, like, non-consensually extracted from their devices. That's the part where we worry about privacy more than we worry about unwise disclosures, though again, unwise disclosures can be a problem too.
Absolutely. And so surveillance, then, when we're also talking something that is not strictly just the government thing here, but just happening in industry, right? This is where big tech comes in, of course, but it happens in the government too. And one of the things that you kind of talk about is there's, you know, this is a symbiotic relationship in many ways, right, that we have. So this kind of idea about surveillance is widespread, right? And mm-hmm. it'd be, you know, a descriptor of our age in many ways, right? About
sure. Yeah, you know, I speak sometimes in Silicon Valley, and when I speak to those people, they say, like, well, I don't care if Google is spying on me. They just want to show me better ads. But, you know, the NSA would sell their mother for a nickel. I don't want them spying on
right,
me, right?
Right.
And then I go to the Beltway, and I talk to, you know, people from the military-industrial complex, and they go, like, well, you know, I already told the government everything that there is to know about me in order to get my security clearance. I don't care if they're spying on me, but, you know, those Google people can't be trusted.
Right.
And the reality is that the reason there's so much forbearance for commercial surveillance is that it acts as an adjunct to state surveillance, that, you know, the NSA or your local law enforcement can't undertake the scale of surveillance that these commercial operators undertake. And they rely on raiding the vast troves of data that are accumulated about you as part of their law enforcement and security function. And so the kind of devil's bargain here is that if these private firms will act as de facto arms of the state and undertake surveillance and data acquisition, the state will forbear to regulate them, despite the many harms that arise from the surveillance, the many ways we get hurt, both deliberately, right, where that information is abused by firms to our detriment. You know, you see that with things like digital redlining, where, you know, you have financial discrimination, other forms of discrimination that's accomplished by racial profiling that takes place through in the digital realm, based on what offers you get and so on, but also the inadvertent harms, right, that arise from breaches. And, you know, any data you collect will probably leak, and any data you store will eventually leak. And, you know, the one way to think about what's going on here is that this data is not particularly valuable. And we're kind of maybe shading into my critique of Zuboff here, that the tech companies want you to think that the data is really valuable, and that's why they have so much of it, and that makes them really rich. And Zuboff kind of thinks that as well. I think the data is really not very valuable. I think that a little pieces of data here and there don't add up to much, and they need a lot of it in order to extract any value from it. It's like Mark Zuckerberg was, like, you know, smoking a bong in his dorm room one day, and he said, you know, everyone's got those oily rags in their garage, and oil is worth money. And if I didn't have to pay for fire suppression, and if someone else would pay when it caught fire, I could just take those oily rags. You know, data was never the new oil. It was always the new oily rag. And so that's why they have to keep acquiring more of it, because the ability to persuade you with the data they already have goes stale very quickly. And, you know, that's why they have such vast troves of it lying around, because a little bit of data, or even a lot of data, doesn't do them much good.
And I kept on having these images as I was reading the book too, as well, about, you know, these giant drums. And it's funny you bring up oil, because I'm thinking, like, that are just constantly being overstuffed with all this data. And so eventually it's going to spring leaks, right? It's going to find, you know, it's going to explode in different kinds of ways. And other people are going to find ways of kind of, like, just tap it into that drum, like, under the, you know, on the cover of night, in order to utilize this stuff.
Yeah, and you know, this is where the metaphor breaks down, because it's worse than that in the sense that it's cumulative. So when you see attacks like you know, there are these credential stuffing attacks where you see a breach, right, that has a bunch of logins and passwords in it, and the attackers will take that data and they'll just try those login and password combos on other services, right? And maybe the service asks you a challenge question like, what's the first street you lived on? Well, then there's another breach that contains that. So now you merge those and you can go after it again. You know, they're thrifty and ingenious, these identity thieves. They're like the Lakota using the whole water buffalo. You know, they use the whole data trove to find ways to harm you. And so, you know, like a couple of years ago, there was this rash of griefers who were breaking into home security cameras with speakers built into them, you know, Ring and Google's Nest and so on, and just like finding nanny cams in kids' bedrooms and like playing pornography.
I remember this, yeah.
And screaming epithets at them. And those attacks were credential stuffing attacks. They were just taking data from another breach and stuffing them in here. And, you know, eventually people get enough data to affect really significant attacks, attacks that aren't attacks of opportunity, but targeted, where, you know, someone is interested in Kevin Mahoney particularly. Mm-hmm. Like someone wants to forge a duplicate deed of your house while you're on vacation and put your house up for sale, which is a thing that happened a bunch in London and New York a couple of years ago, you know, and that's the kind of infinitely ingenious and innovative ways that criminals use all this breach data. And so, yeah, it's like, it's not like leaking oil. It's more like leaking like dioxin or something else that kind of, you know, bioaccumulates, strontium 90 or something.
There you go.
That bioaccumulates. And every time it leaks, everyone gets sicker and sicker and sicker, and you can't unleak it.
Crazy. There's so many places that you could start here, but in the way you kind of, this book in some ways is a responding to Shoshana Zuboff's book, right? The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Why start here? I mean, you know, sure. Why start with this discourse and the argument of this book?
So I think that there is a split that has emerged in maybe what you might call techno-critical discourse, right? People, okay. People who are worried about what technology is doing. And, you know, let's start by talking about the things that the different people within these factions share, right? So I think that by and large, we are excited about what technology could do. By and large, we're frightened about what technology could do, right? This will all be so great if we don't screw it up might be the motto, you know. Mm-hmm. By and large, we think privacy is very important. Right. Those are areas that we all have in common. And I don't question anyone's good faith on those. But the split arises, I think, between people who believe what the tech companies say about their products and the people who say, look, these companies who lie about everything are probably lying about how great their products are, too. Right. And so I would put Zuboff in the first camp, and I put me in the second camp. So, you know, Zuboff looks at the materials that the tech companies produce about the efficacy of their own products, because, you know, they sell persuasion, right? That's what they're selling to their customers, who are advertisers. They say, like, buy ads with us, and we'll figure out how to get people to act on the thing that you're advertising, right? We'll sell your nephew a fidget spinner. And she thinks that what happens is Robert Mercer then goes on and steals that mind control ray and uses it to make your uncle a QAnon racist.
Right.
And, there is another explanation for this.
Well, and then, and that's been the source of a lot of the freak out too, right? In the popular media, that same narrative that you just described.
Sure. Right? Yeah. So there's another explanation for this, right? And that explanation is that advertisers have always lied about how good their advertising is. And the one group of people advertisers reliably are able to convince are people who buy advertising. Right. Like the John Wanamaker, the department store magnate, once said, half my advertising dollars are wasted. I just don't know which half. Like, what an incredible sell job that he thought only half his advertising dollars were wasted. Right. He was completely snowed and he thought that he was wise. That's the best kind of con job when the mark thinks they've gotten one over on you. Right. So the claims that the companies make are pretty thin. And everyone who's ever claimed to be able to bypass our rational faculties and get us to, you know, do things that are contrary to our best interests by convincing us of things that if we were in full command of our faculties, we would not do. they've all turned out to be liars, right? Like Rasputin and Mesmer and the CIA and MK Ultra and pickup artists and neurolinguistic programmers. All of those people are just, they're like either fooling themselves or fooling everyone else. But none of them had built mind control. And the actual basis for believing that the tech companies have mind control is really thin. So they filed patent applications. Patent applications are super, super, super dodgy, right? You don't have to provide a working model. So you can patent like zero point energy and time machines and perpetual motion machines. The fact that the USPTO issued a patent, it's like when you see those companies that make like woo-woo like energy dissipation beads and they say right. they're FDA approved. And all that means is that the FDA has certified that you won't die if you use them. They don't actually certify any of the health claims, right? So, right. you know, the USPTO approved means that you paid for your patent application and that the examiner didn't find that your patent overlapped with anyone else's patent. Doesn't mean you've invented anything.
Well, and I thought that was a fascinating thing, right? The patent could exist if something that they have no idea how to create, right? If it actually yeah. can be created, but it's just a matter of saying there's this space. So it's in a sense, it's a rhetorical trick, right? For the purposes yeah. of marketing.
Well, it's a convincer, right? It's like getting signing your flim flam with doctor because you got a diploma mill to give you a fake PhD in divinity or something, right? There are lots of ways that people put indicia of legitimacy around a dubious proposition to make it seem less dubious. You know, the whole like, well, it's wrapped in shrink wrap. You know, if you've ever, my brother was once ripped off by a guy who claimed to have like a video camera that was still mint in package and that he was selling cheap. And the way the convincer was that he bought a shrink wrap machine. It was a box with a brick in it, but he bought a shrink wrap machine. And if you shrink wrap it, it looks new. It looks legit, right? So, you know, like, the fact that the U.S., if you don't know that shrink wrap machines are just a thing you can get, then shrink wrap looks factory fresh. And if you don't know that patent applications are a thing that just get rubber stamped by the USPTO, whose entire budget comes from patent application fees, right? That's the USPTO doesn't want to turn down patents because they're not funded by a grant from Congress. There's not an appropriation that pays their salary. They're funded from fees. And so when you apply, they rubber stamp it and get the fee and then you apply again. So, you know, that indicia tells you nothing about its legitimacy. And then the one best mark of legitimacy that they have is they did have this peer-reviewed article in a reputable journal about an intervention that Facebook did where they exposed 60 million people to a stimulus that they predicted would increase voter turnout.
Yeah, I remember this.
And they found in the experimental arm, the voter turnout went up by a couple hundred thousand, maybe even 300,000 people, mm-hmm. which is an amazing result, right? When you think of how close elections are. And then you step back and you go, wait a second, they exposed 60 million people to the stimulus. The effect size was 0.39%. Right. So like
and distributed, right? And distributed
across every precinct. So yeah, there are lots of elections that turn on fewer than a couple hundred thousand votes. There aren't a lot of elections that turn on 0.39% margins. Right? That's a one vote margin in most elections.
Yeah.
And when you're exposed to stimulus, generally speaking, the second time it has less of an effect on you than the first time. You know, I have a little sign next to my camera here in my office because this is also the garage, which is also the laundry room. And we have a very loud washing machine. And I have a sign that says, turn off the washing machine, because even though it's very loud, after 10 seconds, I stop hearing it. Right. We all know that effect. Right. And so, you know, if they got a 0.39 effect size on the first outing, well, you know, the first banner ad had a click through rate of over 40%. Today, a banner ad's click through is significantly south of 0.01%. And so the stimulus degrades with repetition. And so, you know, presumably they would be in some kind of arms race to continue to re-stimulate right. us with whatever it was that got us to turn out and vote. So all of that evidence is pretty thin, but then it raises this question. So what's actually going on? Well, I think that there's a couple of things that Zuboff is right to be concerned about. One is that tech companies are taking away our free will, but they're not taking away our free will by bypassing our critical faculties. They're taking away our free will by monopolizing us, right? Like you might hate Facebook, and your friends might hate Facebook, but you can't leave Facebook because your friends are there, and your friends can't leave Facebook because you're there. There's, you know, no one came down off a mount with two stone tablets saying the only way to talk to people on Facebook is using Facebook. Like, I can send you email even if you're not using my mail server, and I'm sure you're not because I run my own mail server, right? And yet somehow we are able to exchange messages. Facebook is not interoperable with rival services, not because it's technically challenging, but because increasing the switching costs creates this system of mutual hostage taking, where I'm on Facebook because you're there and you're on Facebook because I'm there, and both of us have to overcome this collective action hurdle in order for both of us to leave at the same time. And not just us, but all of my friends and all of your friends and all of their friends and all of their friends, which means that we're all just stuck here. Right. You know, my grandmother was a refugee who left the Soviet Union and came to Canada in the 40s. But her family stayed behind, even though they had the same chance to run that she did. And it wasn't because they were enamored with life after the siege of Leningrad and thought things would get great. It was because the switching costs were really high. My grandmother was willing to bear the cost of losing touch with her family for 15 years and abandoning every worldly good she had. The rest of my family weren't, right? Mark Zuckerberg says that the reason he's put a wall around Facebook is to keep the bad guys out. But, you know, the Berlin Wall wasn't supposed to keep East Germans in. It was supposed to keep the bourgeoisie from invading the workers' paradise, right? And so, you know, this barrier that Facebook has put in, this Roach Motel system that Facebook has designed, is designed to lock you in. But that's also a practice of many other services. So, you know, again, like, there's no reason you can't install apps from anyone on your iPhone, except for the fact that Apple has decided that it will be the Lord High Executioner of its app store. There's also no reason that you can't run Apple apps on another device, except for Apple sues companies that make runtimes for its operating system, and so on and so on with Gmail and with all these other services. You know, every question that you want to answer, you probably type into a search box that belongs to Google. And Google's dominance of that search box is not down to having the best search engine. It's Moneyball, right? Right. Like, they pay tens of billions of dollars a year to be the default in every search box. The one deal that Sundar Pichai, I beg your pardon, and Tim Cook do personally every year, the CEOs of Google and Apple, is the deal to put Google in the search bar in Safari and the iPhone, right? And so, you know, that is not an indication of greatness. It is an indication of competence in cheating. I just finished reading Ida Tarbell's History of the Standard Oil Company, her biography of John D. Rockefeller that brought down the Standard Oil Company in the early part of the 20th century. And she has this great thing towards the end, I think chapter 17, where she distinguishes between legitimate and illegitimate greatness. She says, look, John D. Rockefeller ran a hell of an oil refinery, right? Like, he was really good at this stuff. He had all these different refineries under his control, and he kept really detailed stats on them. And if one refinery was doing better than the others, he would put together a technical committee from all the other refineries and send them to the leading refinery so they could replicate their expertise and so on. But John D. Rockefeller was also really good at cheating. Like, he was really good at hiring railroad goons with steel bars, right, to beat the brains out of anyone who tried to join an oil pipeline that ran across a rail line that would have competed with his own oil line, right? Being good at hiring goons is not a thing that qualifies you for greatness. It's an illegitimate form of greatness. And so the tech companies have a lot of illegitimate greatness. And I think they attain that greatness through monopoly. And that monopoly has allowed them to do two things, right? One is that they've deprived us of choice, not out of this kind of consumer fetish of choice, like, you 300 colors of Nikes, but choice in the sense of self-determination, of deciding, like, what regime you want your digital life to be conducted under, right? How you want to connect to that single wire that delivers all of those critical elements. The other thing they've done is they've mobilized the monopoly rents that they received in lockstep, which they can do because there's not many of them. There's half a dozen tech leaders. They all fit around that one table at the top of Trump Tower. Right. Everyone remembers that picture.
Exactly.
Right? That they've used that to hold back policies that would be in the public interest and to create policies that are in their private interest.
Well, and this is like the reverse of the hiring the goons with the steel bar, right? It's also finding the shortest path between the bank account of the, you know, the big tech or Rockefeller, sure, in that case, and the politician's bank account, right?
Oh, I mean, this is that. It. Rockefeller did that too. Exactly. There was a bill that was supposed to pass the Ohio Senate and the sponsor disappeared and turned up in California living in a mansion a month later. So
how'd that happen?
Where'd he get the mansion? Who can say? The mists of time shroud over.
It was the unicorns. It was the unicorns.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's the first thing that's happening, right? Is our lives are being distorted by big tech, just not in this kind of mystical way. And the second thing that's happening is that big tech is a monopoly, not because of anything unique to big tech, right? It's not because of network effects. It's not because big tech is run by worse people or smarter people than other industries. And the way that we know that is all the other industries look like big tech, right, in terms of their market concentration. Professional wrestling is down to one league, right? And the owner of it, Vince McMahon, this billionaire Trump donor, misclassified all of his workers as contractors so he could take away their health insurance. They're all begging for pennies on GoFundMe to die of their work-related injuries in their 50s with dignity, you know? But there's like four big auditing firms who are at the heart of every scandal, yep. And there's like half a dozen energy firms, and there's like five banks, and there's, you know, three record labels, there's four movie studios, there's five publishers about to be four, there's one giant movie theater chain, there's one eyeglass company, one company that makes glass bottles, one company that makes cheerleading uniforms, like four airlines, all with a significant interest with one fund. Warren Buffett has a significant interest in all of them. They don't compete on routes ever since he bought a big share in each of them. Yep. They all pulled out of each other's routes and divided up the country. You know, even though we have like half a dozen big cable and wireline telephone companies in this country, you're lucky if there are two available wherever you happen to live. So, you know, all of that stuff arises out of the same thing. Right.
And this is like, and this, you know, I was reminded of this thing, you know, I had this moment of, say, deja vu from Naomi Klein's work, right? Which just changes, mm-hmm, everything. She talks about the historical accident, right? Of when, you know, when we find out with through science around, okay, look, carbon emissions are going to doom our planet, right? And the deregulatory kind of neoliberal state, right?
Sure.
And so this happens. I mean, it's almost, you know, like to the day, really, we talk about the, you know, when Ronald Reagan comes in and passes these laws, it's the same process we see there.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, 1979, the year Reagan hit the campaign trail, is the year the Apple II Plus came out.
Yep.
So the tech industry and neoliberal deregulation, they follow each other, as the lawyers say, mutatis mutandis, right? Like, as one changes, so does the other, right? And so, you know, at the start of the tech industry, the commercial consumer tech industry, it felt quite dynamic because there was still a little gas in the tank. You know, you would have big companies that would be toppled by small companies. You had IBM fresh off a 12-year antitrust investigation, who knew that they couldn't make their own operating system for the PC, because if they did, the government would smack them around. Mm-hmm. And so they got two guys from Seattle, Paul Allen and Bill Gates, who, you know, came out of nowhere and became billionaires. And then, you know, like you had all of these different companies kind of rolling over. It felt so dynamic. And then as the, I think, really what happened is something microeconomic as well as macroeconomic. I think what happened is that the people in the boardroom, the lawyers who had been scarred by earlier era of muscular antitrust enforcement, retired, or were just, these new firms were kind of, they were young firms. They were like, you know, canonically a couple of Stanford grads, mm-hmm, and they would get some, you know, beer pong buddy from Stanford Law to be their GC. And that person would have never lived through, you know, what they called antitrust's Vietnam, the 12 years that IBM was in antitrust hell and outspending the entire DOJ antitrust division every single year for just one case for its lawyers, right? And so they just didn't know any better, right? They just never been through it. In the same way that, like, there's two kinds of bankers involved in the great financial crisis, the ones who knew better and the ones who didn't, right? And, like, the ones who didn't, there's not really an excuse for them not knowing better. They should have, right? But they do have a different character to their wickedness, because it was a recklessness, not a denial, because they had never lived through the earlier finance bubbles that had led to Glass-Steagall, that had led to other forms of finance regulation that counsel prudence and limited leverage and tried to not allow banks to become systemic threats to the economy and so on. And in the same way, you had all these lawyers who were just like, someone at the boardroom table would be just like, that company is threatening us. Why don't we buy them? And no one at the boardroom table would say, wait, don't say that, right? Don't even think that. So, you know, you like years later,
that's interesting.
You get Mark Zuckerberg at 2 a.m. sending a letter to his CTO, an email to his CTO, basically saying, everybody hates Facebook and they're leaving for Instagram. We should buy them. And then 2 hours later, sending another email that's quite wooden and was clearly dictated by his general counsel, saying, for avoidance of doubt, my previous email was not intended in any way to indicate that I want to do something that might violate the Sherman Act or Clayton Act, right? Like, you know, it's just like real, like just complete lack of any sense of prudence or that there could be any consequences for anti-competitive conduct. And so you have this vast array of anti-competitive activity. So Google, for example, is a company that made 1.5 successful products, a great search engine, pretty good Hotmail clone. Mm-hmm. Everything else they made internally died. Everything else.
Oh, come on. Google Glass. What about Google Glass? Come on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, some of it is stuff I like. I like Google Reader. I wish, you know, I'm still angry about Google Reader, but it just wasn't successful. Right. And everything they've done that's successful, including some things I don't like their ad tech stack, they bought from someone else. Android, right? YouTube. They had Google Video. They had their own versions of all of these products and they all failed, right? They shut them all down and bought good ones from someone else. These are activities that would have been prohibited prior to Reagan. So this is bringing me to my next question, which is like, why is your uncle a QAnon racist, right? Like, because Zuboff wants to answer that question too, because she's like, the reason we've all lost our minds, the freak out as you call it, is because someone out there has figured out how to like rile up the normies. Right. They got the boomers on the run. They figured out how to push their buttons. It's like the Manchurian candidate, but for pedophiles. And
that's the mind control ray, right?
That's the mind control ray theory. And, you know, here's another version of what's going on. The first thing is that an ad tech platform and social media or online media platform does something really well that is legitimately game changing and unique to our era, which is that allows people who have hard to find traits that are widely dispersed in the population to locate one another.
This is fascinating.
Third parties to locate them.
Yes.
Yeah. Targeting, we call it in advertising, mm-hmm. but it's also, you know, if you want to know why your kid is talking about gender as not being a binary, but as a spectrum, it's because for hundreds of years, people have felt this way, but haven't had the words to describe it and haven't been willing to bear the social retaliation that would arise from breaking with the sturdy consensus of gender as a binary. And being able to type the words that are adjacent to how you feel into a search box and find a group of people talking about that stuff together is profound.
Yes.
For better and for worse, right? So we have Black Lives Matter as a consequence of it. We have the Sanders campaign as a consequence of it. We have Nazis in Charlottesville as a consequence of it, right? People who want to carry tiki torches and chant Jews will not replace us are a small group of people widely dispersed across the population who have a hard time locating one another because if you wear your Klan hood downtown, people will talk, right? And so you've got to be able to whisper your true self before you shout it in many kinds of disfavored views, right? So we are living in a moment in which ideas that have lingered at the periphery are moving to the center very quickly. Now, the question of why are people racists, right? Why are people believing outlandish things? Why do people believe in conspiracies?
Right.
Is a different question. And, you know, racism is a question that we can analyze through a lens of class and through a lens of privilege and so on. But conspiracy, you know, the anthropology of conspiracy is pretty clear on this. A belief in conspiracy is an epistemological crisis. It's a collapse in your belief in institutions driven by trauma that has proven those institutions to be untrustworthy. I mean, after all, we live in a world in which we ourselves cannot navigate the truth personally, right? Like, do the research is no answer. Because today you got out of bed in a room that had a reinforced steel joist in the ceiling, the alloy composition of which makes the difference between life or death for you. And then you got something to eat out of the fridge, the food hygiene of which is a life or death decision. And then your kid went to Zoom school, the character of which determines whether they'll grow up to be an ignoramus or not. Right. And then you got in a car whose anti-lock brake software is something that, again, holds the power of life or death over you. Masks, vaccines, outdoor spread, indoor spread. Even if you went and got three PhDs and mastered one of these subjects, you couldn't evaluate the other ones. We have to have a process by which we delegate truth-seeking to experts who themselves are fallible, but whom the process holds in check. So we have these theoretically neutral, adjudicated processes that seek the truth, arrive at the truth, show the working, how the experts sorted through contradictory claims, that show the recusal for conflict of interest, and that have a process for reforming those truths as they were discovered in light of new evidence, right? It's that that is a thing that whose shape we can understand. It's a box we can whose sturdiness we can ascertain, even if we don't understand what's in the box. We can tell that it's a good box. And the box isn't good anymore, because market concentration turns truth-seeking into an auction, right? When firms are very concentrated, policy is corrupted. And it's not like it's not like kind of an abstract thing. Like, it's a very concrete thing. Like, the reason we don't have a privacy law in America is every time someone proposes it, there's a lot of money that's just unleashed
exactly. In
DC on privacy.
Well, healthcare. And even just like you say in the book too, is when you're thinking about like big pharma, you think about the questions about vaccines and things like this.
Sure.
There's a kernel of truth there because they know, they recognize the consolidation of power in the hands of these pharmaceutical companies, right? And so they also know that those people lie. So the question is, and where it crosses over into the kind of conspiracy realm is like, then therefore everything's off the table. Nothing is true. And there's, you know, everything's being manipulated and we cannot, you know, vaccines are lies. Then they're putting like magnetism and chips into us.
Sure. Well, so, you know, there's a great book by Anna Merlin called Republic of Lies, right? Where she traces a line between conspiratorialism and trauma. And she says, you know, look at the prevalent belief among Black people in New Orleans and elsewhere that one of the levees was dynamited during Katrina in order to save the white neighborhoods.
Oh, save the white.
To deflect the water. That's a thing that actually happened in Tupelo, Mississippi, like 70, 80 years before that, right? It's like, it's a thing that happened in kind of living memory. People's grandparents told them in Tupelo, Mississippi, they flooded the Black neighborhoods to save the white neighborhoods, right? And so when they tell you that loud crack that you heard was a levee breaking and not dynamite, and when they tell you that it was just a roll of the dice that flooded this parish and not the one over, the explanatory power that you're being lied to, and that this outcome that harms you and helps someone else who's historically benefited from cheating, from unfairness, it has a lot of explanatory power. Like, I happen to think that the levees weren't dynamited. I looked at the kind of evidence to the extent that I can understand them through the veil of history and so on. I think it probably didn't happen. I think there's plenty of systemic racism in Katrina to go around, right? That we don't have to have more stuff. We can just go there. Like, I used to meet 9/11 truthers, and I'd be like, do you think that we need to indict George Bush with 9/11? Like, do you not think that we have enough incontrovertible, undisputed stuff about George Bush, you know, torture, an endless war, lying our way into endless war, incompetence, Katrina, right? putting a horse breeder in charge of FEMA,
exactly.
All the cronyism, you know, like, why do we even need to go to this disputed area when we can take this area where there's no dispute over the facts at all and indict him there, you know? And so I think that there are a lot of people who have a good reason not to believe that our institutions are serving them. And it leaves them in chaos because you can't figure this stuff out for yourself. And you also can't, you don't have any sturdy boxes whose shape you trust. And so what you're left with is just trying to find someone who sounds like they know what they're talking about. And this is where, like, you get a kind of Douglas Adams theory. You know Douglas Adams and his towel, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you're carrying a towel, people will think, oh, anyone who can hold on to a towel also has, like, a toothbrush and a wallet and a suitcase and a backpack and a sleeping bag and so on. And if you tell them you've lost yours, maybe they'll replace it for you because, look, you got your towel. And so along comes Donald Trump, who says the system isn't working for you. It's rigged, right? The Great Financial Crisis on was just like an 8-year period in which we saw wealth and security move from the great number of people to the small number of people, and it's only gotten worse. Now, it got worse because of policies that he supported, and it got worse still once he took office, right? But, like, just like none of Douglas Adams' characters had toothbrushes and backpacks and sleeping bags, Donald Trump didn't have policies that would make people better off, but he had a towel, right? He was the only politician in the race saying things are messed up, right? Everyone else, yeah. What was Hillary's slogan? America was always great.
Yeah.
Right.
And I have a CV. that was
right. So, you know, like, no wonder, right? And so, you know, people try to put a lot of energy into figuring out why there are Bernie Trump crossover voters. And the thing that the two have in common that's, I think, most dispositive is they both say things are messed up. Things are busted, right? There are other similarities and other differences, and there are reasons, complex reasons that people vote.
But I even think it's a straightforward, like, in many ways, look, most Americans do not pay close attention to what's happening in politics, right? And sure. So, and when they tune in, right? I mean, look where I grew up in upstate New York, and I look at, you know, after all the industry left, everyone lost their jobs and everyone's looking for it. And you have Bernie come out and say this, you have Trump come out and say this. I understand the responses. I understand why a bunch of my former neighbors are now Trumpers. Right. But they could have easily have been Bernie, in the Bernie camp. But it's because it's that visceral response to, like, I've lost everything and I've watched my hopes and dreams go down the toilet. And somebody is acknowledging that. It's not, it doesn't seem to be such a, like, a, you know, such a heavy lift in order to get to that point in some ways. But I think I digress.
That's right. I mean, you know, and I don't mean to excuse the racism. I don't mean to take away the racism. Totally. I just mean to say that, like, if you want to understand what joins those two, I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who are racist, but there's a very small number of people for whom racism is the central fact of their identity.
Right.
Right. Just like there are a lot of people who play video games, but only a small number of people call themselves gamers, and lots of people drive cars, but a very small number of people think of themselves as drivers. Right. There are a lot of people who are racist, but, like, you know, to, you know, the a far smaller number of them have a hood and robes in the closet.
Right.
So, you know, it's a matter of what part of someone's self-conception you speak to. And I think Trump spoke to more than one area of people's self-conception. Maybe he spoke to their self-conception as someone who was disaffected and someone who's a racist, and Bernie speaks to them as someone who's disaffected and someone who thinks that, I don't know, rich people can't be trusted. And, you know, so it's like it's a different valence, but that's the common element.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, back to Zuboff, right? So I think that, like, the connection between the conspiratorialism and the monopoly and the lack of free will can all be made, but only if you're willing to indict capitalism itself. And Zuboff is not willing to do that. She's a Harvard Business School professor, and she wants to characterize the surveillance capitalism as what she calls a rogue capitalism. So, you know, you're probably familiar with this idea that the reason that capitalism is an efficient system, that markets are an efficient system, is that they are a system for aggregating decisions that can never be aggregated through explicit means by asking people stuff or computing it. And so it's kind of a big computer, right? It's kind of a big program that takes all these inputs, these choices, what we buy, what we're willing to pay, what someone's willing to sell for, and it produces an efficient allocation in the end, right? The closest we can get to a great allocation. There's a famous thing in the 20s called the socialist calculation debate in Austria, where, you know, the Austrian economists, the archdukes of capitalism, von Mises and von Hayek, and you had socialist economists, and they were arguing about whether you could ever build a computer big enough to calculate the economy. And, you know, there are people who say we've answered that question today because, like, Walmart, the People's Liberation Army, and the Pentagon are all bigger than the Soviet Union was at its peak in terms of its economy. And none of them run as markets, right? They're all command economies. Right. Like, you know, Party Secretary Bezos has his commissar assign you to a work assignment so that you can make up the five-year plan, right? Like, that's you don't do bids and puts to get a vice presidency at Amazon, right? You don't bank your your savings and then gamble it all, and you know. It's very strictly a hierarchical command economy. But you know, Zuboff says, well, look, if you don't have free will in the market anymore, then the stuff that you buy after big tech shows you an ad is not the stuff you chose, but the stuff they chose for you. And now the system is it's like the worst of all worlds. It's a command economy that is structured not democratically, but structured autocratically by the commissars of these right. large firms. And in that regard, she's right in the sense not that we've lost our free will, but that monopolies do resemble command economies. Like Jeff Bezos's tax on what you can sell, because you can only sell stuff if you put it into Prime, because otherwise it doesn't show up in a search result. Mm-hmm. Once you put it in Prime, the way that Prime has quote-unquote free shipping is that the seller is charged like a 30 to 50% premium when you add up all the different fees. And they're also prohibited from selling cheaper anywhere else, which means that that becomes the price. If they have to raise the price so that they don't lose money on every sale through Prime, yeah. they have to sell at that price at Walmart and at the mom and pop shop and so on. So Jeff Bezos is setting prices and deciding on what products can be sold in the market, right? But he's not doing it by taking away your free will. He's doing it by acquiring competitive advantages through illegitimate means, both vertical and horizontal mergers, and then anti-competitive conduct in the marketplace.
Absolutely. So this gets us right to the point, right? This gets us right to the point where we have kind of two converging. Number one, where you start talking about the solutions, right? And how some of the solutions that are being proposed right now, right, could be even more dangerous, right? Could even actually hand sure. over power to big tech to the point where it's going to be like, you know, the too big to fail and we're never going to get them back. And this is happening. And so you make this case there, right, which we can talk a little about that. And at the same time, now we're having historic, like, regulatory bills that are now making sure. Their way through Congress, right? And those are, from at least my initial read on this, obviously you know better than I do on this one, but those are tremendously positive, right, in ways that are skirting some yeah. of the problems that you suggest in this book, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So when I wrote this book, the most recent round of really significant big tech regulation had just come from Europe. It was things like the Copyright Directive. And the Copyright Directive was designed to, I sometimes pose it this way, that you can either fix the tech companies or you can fix the internet. So if you're going to fix the tech companies, what you do is you try to make them behave, right? You try to basically kind of create a constitutional monarchy where you say, all right, you get to be the rulers forever, but like we're going to surround you with aristocrats who will drape you with golden chains that you will suffer to bear, and they will advise you as to how to like conduct your rule. But the Copyright Directive was like that. The Copyright Directive correctly observed that artistic incomes are in decline, and they are. But they're mostly in decline because of wage theft, right? Because of cheating,
right.
Not because of copyright infringement. It's because you have all of these markets that look like hourglasses, where you have intermediaries, be they labels or tech companies or movie studios or publishers, that control access to audiences. And, you know, they fight among themselves to see who can control the pinch point there at the gateway to the audiences. And what they do is they squeeze their labor force. And, you know, right. as they become ever more concentrated, there are fewer defectors, right? So they all converge on the same terrible terms and so on. I've actually got a book coming out in 2022 called The Shakedown with Rebecca Giblin that is about non-copyright mechanisms for improving the share of creative incomes that go to artists. Giving artists more copyright is like giving bullied kids more lunch money.
No, this is, like, I'm totally psyched to hear this. I've just been doing some research on this on reading about Spotify and what the hell Spotify is doing to music artists.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It's along these lines is like, you know, and that's the big question. Well, then how do folks get paid in this? On the one hand, you've got sure. the promise of like being discovered by people that are really looking for your kind of music, but them putting themselves right in the middle of it all and just kind of extracting it all for themselves.
Well, so that's legit. legitimate and illegitimate greatness right there, right? So Spotify is legitimately great at helping people listen to music,
yep,
and legitimately great at helping people discover music. But here's some illegitimate greatness. One of Spotify's early investors was Universal Music, the largest music company in the world. They control 30% of all the recorded music in human history. Universal negotiated a lower royalty rate for Spotify because the lower the royalties were that Spotify played, the bigger the dividends were that it paid to its investors, including Universal.
Bingo.
Universal has to share royalties with artists, but it doesn't it shares dividends with its shareholders. Royalties are a cost, dividends are a profit, right? So, you know, this idea as well that you have these like that what we must do as creative laborers is find a champion and ally ourselves with them to defend us against the other giants is nuts, because the giants are all on each other's side.
They're all along, right? That table in the boardroom, right?
They're all in the same boardroom. Yeah, they have, you know, Warren Buffett controls a significant interest in all of their companies. It's actually slightly not true of tech companies, only because they all have this weird share structure where like all the voting shares are controlled by Mark Zuckerberg or Sergey and Larry or whatever. But still, they're institutional investors are all the same. So the copyright directive said, all right, what we're going to do is we're going to require everyone who allows the public to communicate in any way to invest in a copyright filter that will find all the copyright infringements and remove them, right? And Google has built something like this called Content ID for YouTube. It costs them $100 million, and it does about 1% of what the copyright directive actually envisioned. So the capital expenditure here that we're talking about is the hundreds of millions to billions of dollars, which means that there's about four companies that will be left once the copyright directive is implemented, right? So you just eliminate at the stroke of a pen everyone who might give artists a better deal, right? Who might emerge to challenge Google's dominance. This is constitutional monarchism.
Right.
And if you think Google treats artists badly now, give them 10 years with no competition and see how you like it, right? We already know, like, so the Texas AG, who's a terrible person who's probably going to end up getting disbarred if not going to jail, is suing Google and Facebook over collusion in the ad markets, to rig the ad markets. Another form of wage theft. You have creators who have ads that show up on their material, and Google brokers those ads as well as Facebook. And Google and Facebook colluded to rig rates, right? Well, if they can do that to publishers, they'll do it to artists too, right? Like, once there's three or four companies, they'll all get together and collude. You know, if you think like Apple will be your champion against Google, Apple and Google colluded to suppress wages in their engineers. They were both part of the no poach agreement, right? So like, they have no trouble collaborating. So then there's another model, right? The model, this isn't to counsel despair, right? This isn't to say we should have no regulation.
Sure, sure. Right, right.
This is to say we should have regulation that doesn't bake in dominance. We should have regulation that promotes pluralism and that promotes fairness and weakens, not strengthens, the power of dominant firms. So what could that regulation look like? Well, in the U.S., we're seeing some of it. Actually, some of it in Europe as well. The House Dems dropped 5 antitrust bills last year.
They're
the most significant antitrust legislation in a century in America. The one that I'm most excited about is the Access Act. And the Access Act is an interoperability bill. So what it does is it requires the largest firms with like a $600 million a year market cap, or $600 billion market cap, I beg your pardon, which is like, you know, it's the same three or four firms that we worry about in Europe that the copyright directive was taking aim at, and requires them to build and maintain an interface that new market entrants can use so that customers of these dominant firms can go somewhere else. So if you start a cooperative for you and your friends to talk about your rare disease, which you've been talking about on Facebook from now on, up until now, you can move that to a more privacy-centered, say, Diaspora instance. Diaspora is this free and open source software thing that was built as a nonprofit that is privacy respecting. And you can interchange messages with the people who are left behind on Facebook. So remember that switching cost thing, right? We hear a lot from tech apologists about network effects. So network effects are when a service gets better the more people there are. So like, you're using Facebook because all your friends are there, because you can't not use it because all your customers are there, and so on. So
right.
Facebook has network effects. Network effects don't matter when you have low switching costs. if you can go somewhere else and still talk to Facebook, who cares if your friends are on Facebook?
Right. And
you
what you're talking
about somewhere else.
Yeah. And what you're talking about, basically, so I go to this other interface and basically you could say, like, there's a button, get my messages from Facebook, and you click on it and then you have the message so that you're not losing out. Right. You're not missing on those things. And then now you've opened a doorway for other folks too, as well, to say, like, hey, you know what? Maybe I don't need to be on Facebook either. Maybe I'm going to move over here to respect my privacy.
And so there's some risks to this. There's some privacy risks. You know, you could get the next Cambridge Analytica, you know, becoming an interoperator with Facebook. And they have put a bunch of stuff in the bill that's probably going to go through even more revisions about privacy. You know, it's a real problem, right? Because the U.S. has yet to pass a federal privacy law. And that means that every time you have a bill that allows someone to do something new with data, you have to write what the privacy rules are in the bill, right? Wow. So it's like, think about how convenient it is that we can say, when you fix a car, it has to be safe. And what we just say is safe means complies with this auto safety regulation.
And then here's this agency, which is going to kind of always be updated based upon new developments in car manufacturing.
Yeah. Right? We don't have to write into every law what a safe car is, because we have a lot of laws about cars. They don't all define auto safety, right? They make reference to something else. And so without that sturdy privacy law, that's a problem. The European Union, because it has the GDPR, which is its region-wide privacy rule, somewhat flawed, but better than nothing, and has some really important and good elements, that puts the European Union way ahead of the US. And they're actually contemplating something called the Digital Markets Act that is also an interoperability rule for big firms. And so they will be able to fall back on GDPR. And we published something last week on Thursday or Friday about this, which was an appendix to a paper we wrote called Privacy Without Monopoly, about how if the only way that we're going to get privacy is by trusting Mark Zuckerberg to keep us safe on Facebook, we're hosed. That, like, ultimately, like, making Mark Zuckerberg a better defender of privacy is a distant second choice to making it easier not to use Facebook so Mark Zuckerberg's not in charge of your privacy anymore. Because, you know, benevolent dictatorships work well but fail badly, right? Yeah. There are a lot of firms that are run by people who are both legitimately and illegitimately great, who are flawed vessels, right? You know, Mark Zuckerberg may be uniquely badly suited to be in charge of the social lives of 2.6 billion people, but it's not like there is someone out there who should have that job.
Right.
That's a job that shouldn't exist.
I was going to say, like, name me the person who would be, right? Yeah. I mean, seriously, I don't care how nice they are.
You know. And so this is an area, again, like I talked about the split before between people like Zuboff and people like me. There's another split emerging between people who think that interoperability will be very bad for privacy. And I think the thing that they don't understand is this idea of illegitimate greatness. That when we promote interoperability, in those things that give people more human dignity and technological self-determination, in the service of both improving those people's lives and weakening the firms that abuse their human rights, so that we can prohibit their abusive conduct. We don't want competition in abusive conduct, right? We don't want a race to see who can abuse your human rights the most efficiently and cheaply and get the most out of you with the least effort. And, you know, some of the competition authorities haven't figured this out. The UK Competition and Markets Authority wrote an amazing and brilliant investigation of the ad tech market, but there's this one area where they look into a thing they call attribution. It's an ad tech term of art. Attribution is what happens when you see an ad and then you are followed everywhere you go, like all your location data, all your transaction data, your credit card data, everything you look at on the web, to see if you buy the thing that you saw the ad for. Now, advertisers like this. That's great. It's creepy. They shouldn't have it. I understand why they like it. It should be abolished. But the Competitions and Markets Authority says, well, look, if the advertisers like it, then one of the ways that will break up Google's control over the ad market is by letting other people deliver it. And then people will like their ads too. And so they propose, like, daffy stuff. Like, what if we assigned everyone a unique government-issued ad tracking identifier that would be permanent and follow them around? It's a bananas idea.
That is insane.
You know, the first, the French government just settled a claim with Google because Google cheats with its ad tech. And part of the settlement was that they would allow rival auctions, because, you know, when you visit a web page and you see an ad, it's the result of a real-time auction, these very fast auctions. They would allow rival auctions, and to make them easier, they would force Google to share targeting information with smaller ad operators. Well, again, this is a race to perfect illegitimate greatness. We don't want perfect illegitimate greatness. We want to abolish illegitimate greatness. And so I understand where the people who worry about the Access Act are coming from, right? They are right to be concerned that competition pursued without regard to what we're competing on, to what goal we are perfecting, what goal we're seeking, that competition does not improve human thriving. It holds us back.
Right. And I think that, you know, one of the things that you say too in the book, and when you're talking about here with this access, I think going back to, like, I don't want to go into Bork and everything like this, but the whole idea that the reason why that you want competition, and what I kept on coming back to this point in the book, the reason why you want competition, not for this kind of like market thing so that you drive down costs so that everybody has more choices of which toothpaste brand to buy at the lowest cost, but to take away the power of those corporations, right? Take away the power. So the whole idea is that if they're forced into a situation where they have to be, say, competitive, right? And be competitive on grounds that are, you know, in favor of, as you say, human thriving, and not the kind of like the lowest common denominator dollar, right? Then guess what happens? They have fewer dollars to spend on the lobbying and the corruption end of things, right? And they have to worry more about the spread out. And again, I understand you're also saying that's not the end of the game, right? That doesn't get us to the end of the road here. But as a wedge into kind of like pushing back against that power, I found that as just a profound insight. It sounds like there's some of that in this Access Act you're talking about.
Well, and the Klobuchar bill explicitly says we are no longer going to limit ourselves to considering those areas that Ronald Reagan and his court sorcerer, Robert Bork, who's a Nixonite criminal, said that we should concern ourselves with, which is this idea of consumer welfare, which means low prices. And we are going to consider social harm, what used to be called the harmful dominance problem, right? So not did you make the prices go up, because the problem with you said you didn't want to get into Bork.
And no, it's but
Bork, you know, Bork came out of Chicago school and he said, like, look, antitrust is squishy, right? So when you're talking about harmful dominance, you go in front of a judge and the judge makes a call about whether your dominance is harmful, and that's like not an objective standard. You could get two people who have like nearly identical facts, two firms that have nearly identical facts in front of two judges and get a split. And this isn't equal justice before the law. We need math. We need to take a thing we can measure. So he says, let's make it prices. But of course, prices aren't objective facts in the world. So if a price goes up, did it go up because two firms merged or because their inputs went up, right? Like maybe labor went up or energy went up, or maybe the moon is in Venus, right? Who knows why the price went up, right? There's a whole debate around in economics about the theory of prices, where prices, it's hundreds of years old, this debate about prices. So, and then, you know, if two firms are going to merge and you're going to predict whether they will put the prices up, again, this is like very, it's very mystical, right, to see this.
That's right.
And so he said, oh, it's okay, though, because we have revitalized economics. Now it's a science. And we use math, not like those hippie anthropologists, right? We use math to figure out the economy now. And as everyone knows, math is objective. My dad's a mathematician, right? I respect math. But, you know, the iron law of computing remains garbage in, garbage out, right? Multiplying imaginary numbers can produce any outcome you want. And these models that the Chicago School would build, they were very complex technical models. And only people from the Chicago School knew how to build them. So the thing about a harmful dominance standard is when the judge wants to figure out whether or not two companies that have merged or contemplating a merger will hurt people, all the people who think they've been hurt or think they will be hurt have standing to show up and talk about how it hurts them,
right?
The harm, right? When it's math, only the people who understand the models have standing. And so we go from this world of dialogue, of multi-stakeholder dialogue, right? into this world of like court sorcery, where the king contemplates a course of action. He summons the court sorcerer, who drags in a goat, and he cuts the goat's throat, spills its guts on the floor, reads the future in the guts, and announces that what the king wanted is what the fates have in store for us all along, right? And if a courtier has the balls to look at the goat's guts and say, I don't think that's what those goat's guts say, the court sorcerer can go like, look who thinks he knows how to read the guts of a goat.
Right, right.
You
didn't
go to the University of Chicago. Who are you to read a goat's guts? Right. And so, you know, by removing the discourse from the realm of human experience and into the realm of an abstract mathematics practiced only by a cult from the University of Chicago Economics Department, they were able to just hijack all of the debate with this kind of empirical face wash, right? This idea that the numbers don't lie and they know how to make the numbers work. And we've all been there, right? We've all seen how someone can use empiricism to bamboozle you, you know?
It's the best way to do it, right? I mean, it's because it has the appearance, exactly as you said, it has the appearance of fact and truth.
It's like predictive policing, right? You know, the thing that if you ask a statistical inference engine where crime will be, it will tell you that crime is likely to be where crime was. The thing is that where crime was is not the same, or where the police found crime is not the same thing as where crime was.
Right.
You know, if you only ask black people to empty their pockets, everyone you bust for simple possession of weed will be black.
Exactly.
Because the only way you'll discover simple possession of weed is by asking people to turn their pockets out. It tells you nothing about the overall incidence of weed in people's pockets, to say nothing of the justice of busting people for simple possession.
Yeah, and the lack of enforcement of people on Wall Street, for example, right?
Sure,
where they're not,
sure.
Or college
campuses.
Like,
there are lots of ways that this echoes down. So, you know, for example, domestic violence calls are systematically underreported in detached dwellings, because the most common way that domestic violence is call-outs happen is a neighbor hearing it through a wall, right? So if you don't live in an apartment building and your partner is beating you up, they'll probably get to beat you up for longer before someone calls the cops on them, right? So there are lots of ways in which it's iniquitous. But what predictive policing does is it predicts what the police will do. And it predicts it with 100% accuracy, right?
And there you go.
Because if the police only go where the algorithm tells them to go, then all the places the algorithm tells them to go will be places where they detect crime. And so that empirical face wash is a common feature. You know, the goal of like trying to have equal justice under the law is not outrageous, right? And it makes sense to say like it would be nice if we could replace these squishy metrics with something that's crisper, so that we're not dependent so much on a judge's, you know, idiosyncratic views of whether your harms count or not. But, you know, what the overcorrection, such as it was, in fact, it wasn't even an overcorrection, it was deliberate sabotage disguised as a correction, took us into a world of total antitrust forbearance, where nothing is ever wrong. It's like all those simps for billionaires, right, after the ProPublica tax expose, who are like, well, don't you think people should be able to own something, comrade? It's like, look, you and I might disagree about what the proper tax rate is, but can we agree that the proper tax rate for a billionaire should be more than zero?
Yeah, I mean, come on, let's start there.
We may disagree on what the right framework is for antitrust, but, you know, converting the web into five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four is not good competition policy.
Well, and this is where, okay, so I mean, so I want to bring, say, a few things together here, because one of the things you say, we go back to Bork, and I found that whole discussion fascinating. But going back to Bork, you see here, the other thing that you say is like, look, persuasion is something that happened that takes a long time to do.
Yeah.
And essentially what happened with that Bork example is that we have been persuaded over a long period of time that this is how we do antitrust. But then you say, right, as well, you get kind of towards the end of the book, to as well say, look, everything that we need, or let's say a lot of really good tools that we have, are already in the antitrust legislation that we already have. So theoretically, and this goes back to some of the things the American Prospect would talk about, right? The idea that, you know, Biden could come in here and basically saying, hey, Attorney General Merrick Garland, we're going, this is what these terms mean, and this is how we are going to force these laws.
Enforce the law. Yeah.
Right.
For
so,
sure.
So there you have number two. And then you have this bill. Let me just throw this other last piece in.
Sure.
And you have this bill that's kind of coming out that's kind of saying, okay, we're going to start a re-persuasion project. We're going to go back and talk about what antitrust is. You said, Amy Klobuchar says. And the thing is that brings us also back to the kind of coalition of people who all are already kind of like in the room. They're not on the same page necessarily, but when it comes to wanting to kind of limit the power of these corporations, you've got a constituency there that it has to be assembled. So this seems to be like a coming together, really important coming together at this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should wrap up because
that's exactly what I
door here. But you know, maybe the right place to end this is with the ideas of James Boyle at Duke University's copyright scholar there. Who talks about the meaning of the coining of the term ecology. Before the term ecology came along, you know, some people cared about owls and some people cared about the ozone layer. And it's not obvious that, like, if I care about charismatic nocturnal avians and you care about the gaseous composition of the upper atmosphere, that we have a common interest, right? Maybe I'm like, oh, that Kevin and his ozone obsession, that's fine. He's not a bad guy, but, like, he's not fighting for the owls.
Right.
Right. The term ecology takes 1,000 issues and makes it into one movement. Owls and whales and freshwater and acid rain and ocean acidification and forests and, you know, everything. It becomes one giant issue. And today there's people who are angry about what's happened to their favorite pro wrestlers, or that there's only two beer companies left or two spirits companies left, or, you know, the couple grocery companies, or, you know, that one giant bookstore. That and all of those people, they have a right to be pissed off, and they think that they're pissed off about the corner of the problem that they've got hold of. What they're really pissed off at is monopolism. And if we can fuse those people together into a single movement, we won't all agree, right? Like, in the same way that, you know, we talked about this difference between Zuboff and me, and we talked about
right.
the difference between the people who are worried about privacy and so on. Just like there's people who are like degrowth lefties, greenies and bright greenies. And, you know, like, there's a lot of room within the environmental movement to disputes about nuclear power and carbon trading and so on. Like, there are real legitimate deep divisions, but they're all part of the discussion about ecology, right? Like, nobody disagrees that there is a thing called the ecosystem, our environment, and that we need to save it with by respecting ecology. And in the same way, if we can get this broad constituency to all agree that there is such a thing as a problem with monopoly, and that we all need to be on the same side to fight it, we'll have our divisions, but we'll be unstoppable.
Well, there you have it. I think no better place to kind of wrap this up tonight. Corey Doctorow, I really appreciate the time taken out. The book, again, is How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. Head on over to craphound.com and check out all of Corey's work. And I'll tell you, pick this up. We didn't get a chance to talk about your fiction and the science fiction here, but I'm telling you, all of this revolves around this stuff. And there's no better way to introduce your kids also to these issues here. So I appreciate the time. Thank you all for tuning in tonight. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We will be back next week. We'll be back on Wednesday and Friday and next week. Can't wait to see you then. Hey everybody, thanks for tuning in. See ya!